I would like to thank all of you to have stayed till the end of the conference. Hopefully you not get too bored by my talk. So yeah, I'm going to talk about quantum hypernetworks, which is basically how we could train a specific type of neural network called binary neural network using quantum secrets. But before that, of course, one has to talk about ChatGPT. And I believe that a lot of us, we've witnessed almost every now and then there's kind of a new headline about the latest milestone that ChatGPT has accomplished. And for sure, we can say that it is very trendy. So I would like to check the trend here. How many of you have used ChatGPT? Almost everyone, all right? So there's actually a dirty secret about ChatGPT and any other large language model or large generative AI. And that dirty secret is it consumes a lot of power, and it is not good for the planet. So there was this estimate where they checked that training GPT-3, which is kind of one of the model in which the original ChatGPT is partly trained on, consumes a little bit above 1,200 of megawatt of electricity. And to give you an idea of how much carbon dioxide equivalent it generates, is like 550 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, which is you taking an aeroplane from New York to San Francisco 550 times. It's not so cool. To land the point a little more, in this very nice paper about energy and policy conciliation of deep learning, so this is you or I taking an airplane from New York to San Francisco. That's how much of carbon dioxide emission equivalent that we generate. An average human will generate this amount per year. An average American apparently generates 3 times the amount. If you have a car, basically you generate this kind of amount in fuel and driving of carbon dioxide equivalent. So we kind of relate more or less to this carbon footprint that we all have. But what about you sitting on your desk and training on a GPU, a large language model? So if I take, say, for example, transformers, just training a bit transformers forward pass is about 200 of L-based carbon dioxide equivalent. But the problem comes when, as we are all machine learning practitioners, you have to do the loop of changing the hyperparameters, changing and testing architecture. That loop takes up to 3 orders of magnitude, generates up to 3 orders of magnitude more carbon emissions, which not so good. The other news, which is also not so good about generative AI, is that it's very thirsty. It consumes a lot of water to actually train and also inference, also for the part of using electricity, I didn't talk about inference. Inference is about 80 to 90% of the lifetime of a typical machine learning model. So you could imagine the numbers. So for water, they estimated in this very recent paper that training GPT-3 on state-of-art US data center could consume directly about 700,000 liters of potable water, right? And they also estimate in that paper that every time you interact with ChatGPT is about 0.5 liter of water that you consume, which is kind of nothing times the millions of people we've interacted with that. That's already quite a huge number. So in case you wouldn't want to think about the ethics of AI, I hope that this slide make all of us, as we started already the discussion, think about the ethics of AI and, I mean, the effect of our research on the environment. The good news, though, is that a lot of people are thinking about building new models that are energy efficient, that are also more portable, right? And that can keep the more or less the same accuracy as these large language models. And I want to talk about one of those. And this is binary neural network. So what are binary neural networks? So standard neural networks in this kind of very cartoonish picture have weights, biases, activation functions that are real numbers. All right. In binary neural network, the weights and the activations are constrained between two values, -1 and 1. You could immediately see that you can have a huge gain in terms of storage by just using a single precision bit in the weights biases and activation function. However, as I mentioned in a bit, the training of the binary neural network actually still perform on the floating point value of the weights. But they use some activation function to binarize it. I'm going to mention it in a bit. And it's only at inference that you leverage the memory slash computational efficiency slash energy efficiency. Right? Why is this so? Well, in a typical example of a matrix vector operation, which is one of the operations that consume the most time when we are actually training a large neural network, we all know that you basically have a matrix of your weights, and then you basically have matrix vector multiplication with input, you add a bias, and then you have the activation. That, this is what we know. In a binary neural network, where you have this one-bit representation of your weights, biases, and activation function, you have an input. So the first thing you do is basically to binarize it, maybe with a sine function. So you binarize your input, you binarize your weights and biases by taking the sine, let's say minus one and one, and then you perform the matrix vector multiplication. You add a bias that is also binarized, and you apply the activation. But you could recognize that this step at inference could be accelerated because a matrix vector multiplication could be performed with this kind of bitwise operation, the XNOR, and then the summation could be implemented with the pop count. And this is kind of where you could see somehow the speed advantage of not only the memory advantage, but also the speed advantage at inference time with this binary neural network. All right, so actually, the way the binary networks are traditionally trained in a machine learning pipeline, as I mentioned, you have this sine function that gives either minus one or plus one values, right, of your weights and activation function. But the issue with that is this is not trainable, right, because the derivative in the backward pass is zero. So no way that you can leverage backpropagation to be able to train this neural network. So what people typically use is that at the backward pass, instead of using the actual sine function, they use some sort of approximation of the sine function, which, for example, is this function here, that actually gives you, on some range, a non-zero value of the gradient. This is called the straight-through approximator. So again, the forward pass, you have your real weights biases, you part with sine function, and then you have your binary weights. The backward pass, you use a straightforward estimator that uses an approximation of the sine function to compute the gradient. So this is typically, in a very high level, how a binary neural network is trained in the machine learning framework. So now I'm going to present and show some results which are not my results. This actually is very nice. I don't know why this is doing that, but yeah. Hopefully you can see the archive. This is a very nice review paper on binary neural networks in case you are interested. So they give a lot of results. I'm just showing some results on the CIFA dataset, which is just an image dataset with 10 labels of full precision-based convolutional neural networks and their accuracies, and the more or less equivalent with different kind of topology of binary neural networks and their accuracies. So you see that though the binary neural networks have decent accuracy, they are very far away from the full precision ones. But as time is going on and more research is being done, you see, for example, here you have a 95% accuracy, and here like 95.75, 95.39. So the gap is closing, right? But then if you look at the best performing floating point neural network, which I believe uses visual transformers or something like that. Yeah, its precision on the CIFAR is 99.5. So you really see that there's still a gap with binary networks. But the gap is closing. And especially if we could leverage what has been shown in this paper, where you could have 100% more energy efficiency by running this, accelerating this binary neural networks inference on FPGAs, compared to GPUs that consume in general more energy. And we could leverage, for example, a 32x memory in comparison to a 32 floating point representation while having a 2x computational speed, it will still be very good and decent accuracy for binary neural networks, especially that you can put it on edge devices. You can put it on your phone. You can put it on any memory efficient or device that needs less energy. So this is kind of one of the motivations of pushing forward the development of binary neural networks. So this is kind of a typical machine learning pipeline. So you have your data set that you prepare. You have kind of the first idea of the architecture that you want to use. You train it, and then you have this loop about changing architecture, training again, changing hyperparameters, training again, evaluating the model, you're not satisfied, you change things, maybe you train again, until you're satisfied and you deploy your model. That's what we call the inference. So right now, the advantage in using binary neural network is leverage only at the inference time. So we ask ourselves in our project, could we do something better? Could we provide an average before the inference steps? Especially as I mentioned, that the nested training of hyperparameter and architectural search can cause 3 orders of magnitude more cost, right, in training. So if we could combine those costs in a single loop, can we reduce the binary neural network training? Because again, for the current way of training binary network, it still uses floating point. So you still have the computational cost of this nested loop. So we thought that we could combine this step using quantum computers. And I would like to highlight a very recent paper by Google and Lisa Ames folks, where basically they did again the famous quantum supremacy experiment. But the idea here was checking the energy advantage of using a quantum device. Especially this, so they kind of compared the quantum simulation with Summit, which is the currently, according to them, fastest supercomputer in the world. And they showed that they have an advantage of many orders of magnitude in energy consumption on using NIC's device over using HPC architecture, which I guess we all know HPC consumes a lot of electricity, right? So this tells us that quantum computing could provide an even energy advantage. And if we could combine that energy advantage with the one of binary networks, that would be great. But let's see whether I could do that. So that is kind of the framework, the motivation that we had in pursuing this work. So quickly, I will mention some previous work that people have done in training binary networks with quantum computers. We are not the first to have thought about that. So there's this work where they basically use quantum annealing formulation to train a binary network. They transform the loss function in some sort of Kubo, and then they perform quantum annealing. So this is not kind of the approach that we take. We take a circuit-based approach. You have these other two papers that actually do use a circuit-based approach to try to train a binary neural network. The quantum advantage they claim here is because they use a search algorithm. So imagine if you have a binary network, you have a huge space, an exponentially space that scales 2 to the n, for example, with the number of, with the system size, and they devise a search algorithm, basically, in searching for the base train that has the highest amplitude, with quantum amplitude estimation. And here they find kind of a trick to be able not only to find the weights, the binary weights and biases, but also to have a metric that decides whether you are pruning or not, whether you have a connection or not. So we don't use this kind of approach. We want to leverage the fact that these devices have, you probably don't want to have a large circuit depth. And we want to use hardware efficient quantum gates. So this work instead has is a little bit closer to what we did. The difference is that they are not seeking. So basically what they are doing is, instead of solving or instead of finding the base string that minimizes the cost function that gives you the solution of your binary neural networks, they actually look for the probability distribution of the best solution of your binary neural networks. It's kind of a Bayesian approach. So they basically train the parameterized quantum circuits to capture the probability distribution. So we have a similar approach. The difference is that we combine the training and the cross-validation together, which again, as I mentioned, can have huge energy advantage. So this being said, how do we put binary neural network in quantum superposition? So suppose that you have this simple cartoon where you basically are seeking to label an image. For example, here I want to have this giving me one very, very high probability. So if I have this binary neural network, so we are interested in learning these binary variables. Sigma 1, sigma 2 are the weights, which can take value 0, 1. Sigma 3 is the binary variable that represents the bias. And now the novelty that we are bringing is that we also want to encode a choice of the architecture. So here this binary variable encodes an architectural choice, which is the choice of the activation function we want to have. So if my binary variable is 0, I want the forward pass to use an activation function F1. If it is 1, I want it to use an activation function F2. And if you want to have more versatility, just add more qubits with whatever choice you want. All right? So in this sense, you have an augmented weight vector that encodes not only the need for you to find basically the weights and biases of your neural network, but also the choice of the architecture. And you minimize it in this case, maybe in a supervised learning approach where you perform the forward pass, giving basically your input or your training data set. And then you have some sort of loss function that compares how well your neural network is able to predict the label. And then, of course, you do the summation of over a certain number of training examples. And you want to minimize that cost. So how do we make it quantum? Well, we make it quantum by simply promoting this augmented weight biases and choice of the architecture to this basically set of Pauli Z matrices. All right, and then we could use now basically the eigenvectors of those, the tensor products of these eigenvectors as a computational basis, kind of. And we want to be able to assign a high amplitude to the set of measurements that basically minimize our cost function. You could immediately see that this is nothing else than putting your binary neural networks in quantum superposition so that you can explore all the possible combinations of your binary variables. All right? So in practice, we parameterize this wave function. And we parameterize it with a quantum circuit, where theta is just a vector, the usual thing of rotation angle in rotation X, no, rotation Y and rotation Z of your quantum circuit. And you want to find the vector theta star for which the expectation value of your permitted cost function, that is now the Pareto, over your ansatz is minimized. All right? So in practice, you basically have these unitaries at each basically depth k, where you have rotation ri, rotation z, and then you can add some entanglement with some sort of synod gates. And the idea is simply that you time evolve your quantum circuit, you measure the measurement of your quantum circuit. So in this, while you're evolving, you put it in quantum superposition, you measure. And the measurement corresponds to weights, biases, and choice of the architecture of your binary neural network. And you simply do the forward pass to be able to make the prediction. So why is it called an hypernetwork? So an hypernetwork is a complicated term for a very simple thing, which is an hypernetwork is a neural network whose output is the input of another neural network. Very simple. So since our quantum neural network output is an input to a classical neural network, we call it quantum hypernetwork. And it's variational because we need to basically learn the parameters that actually minimize the machine learning parameter interested in. So that's the simple scheme of variational quantum hypernetworks. So the way you will train it on a quantum device is the usual suspect. You basically generate some shots, right, projective measurements. You evaluate your cost function on that, and then you could find a gradient with exactly the parameter shift rule, and so on and so forth. So in practice, we actually don't do that. We leverage, as we discussed yesterday, tensor networks. And we basically represent the quantum circuit with tensor network, and we compute the expectation value exactly and the gradient exactly with automatic differentiation. All right, results. Maybe I stop here if there are questions. Okay, it's too simple. No. Sorry, guys, it's too simple. All right, results. So we present result on this is a kind of very vanilla generated Gaussian mixture data set. But the idea is this. The idea is that we generate this data set made up of a Gaussian mixture where points are drawn here with probability from this red data distribution with probability 1/2 and with probability 1/2 for these three, so 1/3 for each one. We draw a point in this blue distribution. So the idea is to be able to, given a point in space, to be able to classify from which distribution is coming from. And we do it basically with this binary neural network architecture where we want to learn the weights of the first layer, its biases, the weight of the second layer, the bias, and the choice of the activation function here. So this is a very simple problem. We only have 14 qubits. We can do full enumeration. And if we do full enumeration and we compute basically the cost function, we take the configuration that gives the lowest cost function, we actually obtain this decision boundary that separates basically the two data sets, just to check that indeed this neural network does the job. But then we want to check it also with putting our quantum a binary neural network in quantum superposition. All right, again, the task is binary classification of this 2D data point. We want to optimize weight biases and architectural choice of the nonlinearity. So what we do is that we run the optimization with 200 initial different initialization of your quantum circuits. And we basically look at, we evaluate the probability of finding an objective function with value E theta. So what we plot here is actually the kernel density estimation of the probability of finding this energy E theta for the product state, for one layer quantum circuit, two layer, three layer, and four layer. And for this C, what we basically do is that we do the full enumeration, but to be consistent with this 200, we take the lowest 200 configuration of from the full enumeration, and we also do a kernel density estimation of that, which kind of gives you an idea of the density of state of your system to find it within a certain energy. So the red line here is the line that gives the lowest cost function. So this is an overestimation because of the way the kernel density estimation works. But what is interesting is to see that we have a peak for all of our runs of, though you have a classical state, a product state, but also the quantum state, you have a peak around the lowest energy, around this red line. Whereas when you look at the density of solution around the lowest energy cost function, it's very, very low. So this tells us that the quantum optimization is actually very effective in solving the problem. So to be able to kind of quantize or quantify how effective it is in solving the problem, we look at basically the probability of finding a solution within a given tolerance, epsilon. I think epsilon here is like 0.03. So we estimate this probability by just taking the fraction out of this 200, the fraction that is within this interval. So what we notice is that already for the product state, we already have like more than 58%, sorry, probability in finding the right or the lowest cost function or the best choice of the binary neural network within this tolerance. So when we reduce, we actually increase, put entanglement with this first layer, we see a decrease of that probability. It is kind of not very clear to me why there's this decrease. Maybe it's a problem of landing in a near optimized solution. As you can see, we have quite a couple of runs that stop in a metastable or higher energy state. But when we increase the number of layers, we see that indeed increasing entanglement does increase the probability of solving the problem. But it seems to me there seems to be an optimal entanglement, because at four layers we see that this probability decreases. But again, we can see that here the distribution kind of increases. So it's probably not likely to the fact that your ANSAT is powerful enough, it has enough entanglement, but it's more likely that you are maybe not training it effectively. So in any case, what is undeniable is that entanglement does increase the success probability here. So it's a quantum resource that is useful in this case. So next, we try to increase a little bit the complexity of our binary neural network by encoding on top of the choice of the weights and the biases and the nonlinearity. We want to encode basically the choice of the number of hidden neurons we have in this first, in this only hidden layer. And we want to encode this choice in the qubit. All right, depending on whether our qubit is giving measurement one, we will use these three neurons to do the fourth pass to compute the cost function. If it is not, we only use two neurons. And only using two neurons in this neural network, you immediately see that you are not going to use this weight and biases. So there's kind of a typo here. It's supposed to be 12. You will not use this weight and biases. And you are not going to use this weight. So what happens is that when you measure your quantum circuits, if, the qubit that indicates the number of hidden neurons is basically, let's say, zero, then you don't touch these measurements when you evaluate your fourth pass. That's as simple as that. So results, we run the same simulations, and here we see that the general trend is kind of the same. Again, we have a peak around the lowest energy of our variational quantum circuit. But then we have more pronounced peaks for metastable or for high energy, right? So the cool thing is that we have a peak when, again, the density of states, that is the number of solutions or the number of bit strings that gives you the lowest cost function, is very, very low. So this, again, speaks of the fact that still the quantum optimization is successful, but it's successful with a lower probability compared to before, where we were in the 50s. Right, percent of solving the problem. Again, we still see that there seems to be an optimal level of entanglement that maximizes the probability of solving the problem, but this four layer is definitively hard to train, I guess. All right, so next we tried a little bit more realistic data set, which is the MNIST data set, but really reduced MNIST data set, 4x4 pixel. I can tell you this is very hard to solve, because when we're like plotting the images, sometimes I, human being, I cannot recognize what is this thing. But interesting enough, we have a very high peak of the probability of finding the lowest solution around actually the actual lowest solution. And the probabilities, the fraction of the number of bit string around the exact solution is really high, reach up to 90% right, efficiency in solving the problem. And I'm going to talk in a while why it is so. All right, so we have a high success of probability. Again, there seems to be this optimized circuit depth. So for us to kind of understand why there was kind of this discrepancy in the fraction of the solutions that we were able to find, we wanted to have an idea of whether this cost function or the cost function that we use for the different settings, like the Gaussian data set only with the activation function choice, the Gaussian data set, the activation and the choice of the number of hidden layers in the number of hidden neurons in the hidden layer and the reduced MNIST. So we wanted to know basically how k-local our cost function is. And basically, we can always expand the cost function on basically the basis set of the identity and the Pauli matrices. Since the cost function is diagonal, we only need the identity and the Pauli Z matrix, right? So we have the entries here. And we look at this metric here that we call WS that basically tells us the coefficient in front of the polynomial we'll have if we are expanding this function here. So it tells us how k-local, basically, the objective function is, which in principle you expect to have a complicated, maybe all-to-all interaction. But that's actually not the case, because when we look at this, so notice that this is a log scale. And here we increase the number of nodes. So S, you could see it as the number of sigma Z Pauli matrices that are in this, that are basically not identity. Let's put it that way. So S equals to zero simply means that you have a constant in the energy that you can for sure shift. S equals to one means that you have independent, in the spin language, independent spin, Hamiltonian with independent spins. S equals to 2 means that you have a pairwise easing-like interaction, and so on and so forth. So here we see that the dominant interaction are 2-local and kind of 3-local, right? And the rest basically decrease exponentially, all right? So one thing that you notice is that as we increase the choice of number of hidden neurons we can have in a binary network, so 2-local and 3-local become a little bit comparable, right? So this is maybe explaining the reason why we saw the drop in the accuracy when we added that feature in training the binary neural network. Interesting enough, beside the trivial constant shift, the highest weight that we have for the MNIST, the reduced MNIST dataset, is actually 1-local, which means that the dominant contribution to the cost function are independent local fields that we can literally solve with 1 qubit. So maybe that's the reason why we saw like this almost 90% probability of solving the problem on the MNIST dataset. So in general, our loss function is predominantly local, which I guess for this dataset is good news, because if it was not local but global, you might imagine that you have issues with vanishing gradient. But here we don't see that. All right. So another thing that we checked, because what we really wanted to do is to see whether we could combine training and cross-validation in a single step, which we did. But we wanted to see whether our result, we are still able to generalize. Okay? To unseen dataset, and whether we are not overfitting our dataset. So the way we check it is that we revisited our classification problem with this architecture, but then we brought the Gaussian a little bit together to bring noise and make it harder to be able to classify, and we reduced considerably the training dataset size. We did, we computed the cost function average over 100 independent realization of those training data set. All right. So what do we observe? When we only have 2 data points in the training, and you look at basically the loss function during training, you have a very rapid decrease, as you would expect, to a very low value. But when you basically evaluate that loss function on seen data set for 1,000 samples is very, very high. So the generalization error is very high. This is a typical example of overfitting. All right? But when we increase the number of training data points, so for 8, this is the training curve. This is the value of the cost function on the validation data set. Already you see that the gap is decreasing. So for our largest training data set, 1,000 training and 1,000 validation, you have this orange curve where you really see that the generalization gap is very low. The validation curve is above the training one and it's behaving typically as a nicely trained machine learning model, right? So this tells us that indeed the step of training at the same time, the weights, the biases, and the architectural choice did not hamper, if you have enough data point in your training, it did not hamper either generalization or it didn't bring about overfitting. So it was successful to combine those steps together in this setting. So it's possible to do it. All right. So we also did some simulation. So this is ongoing work. And I wanted to present preliminary results on a reduced MNIST data set, but on a larger kind of picture, 8x pixel. So why is this kind of interesting to us? It's interesting to us because already with an 8x8 logistic regression classifier, you have 64 weights, one bias, and one qubit for the choice of the activation. So you basically need a 66 qubit quantum device to be able to train. This is way beyond full enumeration, right? And so we are exploring a space of 2 to the 66, which is a dimension way beyond the number of parameters of large language model right now. All right? So what we did is we look at the test set accuracy during the training of our, okay, we still use, in this case, tensor networks. But what happens is that we basically generate a number of shots at each training, like 1,500, and then we optimize over, the gradient of this shot using quantum natural SPSA. For the expert. All right, so the test accuracy when we take the full sample mean of this 1,500 shots is increasing to a value that is hopefully approaching 90, but maybe we need more iteration. But what is more interesting is that when we look at the best performing shots, or the best performing shots that gives basically higher test accuracy on the problem, 1%, 5%, and 10%, you see that it is actually converging very fast, right, to above 90. And this could be kind of a criterion for you to even stop your training. For those who are familiar, you could use even the SIVA to train. So this is the cross entropy loss on the full sample and it's nicely going to zero. So another thing that we tested, which is pretty cool, is that at the end of the training, we sample our MPS 10,000 times and we basically draw this histogram of the test set accuracy. And so the activation function that we were checking is to choose between the sigmoid and the arctan, which is this one. And we see a very nice, test set accuracy on this problem. Interesting enough, both sigmoid and arctan activation function give high test accuracy, but for some reason, sigmoid has more percentage of shots with higher test set accuracy. Still not clear to me why, right? Because it's kind of the same, a single MPS that is doing that. So somehow maybe it has learned that I mean, the gradient of the actin is maybe less favorable than the gradient of the sigmoid function. So we still have to figure out whether there's a metric we could extract from the MPS that will give us an idea of why the choice of sigmoid versus actin. All right. So that was it. In conclusion, we've demonstrated training of binary network using variational quantum circuits. We showed that quantum effects such as entanglement were shown to enhance optimization. Training hyperparameters and architectural searches were successfully combined in a single optimization loop. And we kind of advocate that possible that training binary neural network quantum computers will help reduce the carbon footprint. But again, substantial work is needed if you want to rival deep learning like model, right? So we have a couple of ideas on scaling our method. One was discussed on Monday about this multi-basis encoding. So imagine that we basically train, we cut the size of our binary neural network and we put it on a couple of different quantum computers that interact with some quantum channels, and then we train on this enhanced loss function. Hopefully we can train much larger binary neural network using much less, I mean, quantum circuit with less resources. We also have to check this on actual device, because there's noise, things are not so nice as simulating it classically, so it would be good to see whether we have, the same advantage on an actual device. Another cool thing to try will be using this adaptive player learning, because right now we just kind of impose what the structure of our quantum circuit should be. But it'd be cool to basically learn on the fly, and there's been work about building your quantum circuit on the fly as you are optimizing your cost function. So this could be another nice direction. Another direction I was thinking about is maybe making the training more effective with this Koopman learning operator that was shown to basically accelerate the training even on actual quantum device with noise. So yeah, so there's a cool possibilities of branching out of this work. And with that, I will thank my collaborators, especially one, he did most of the work. So I should acknowledge that. And thank you, I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Thanks, Estelle. Questions?
Thanks. I wanted to check if I understood correctly your 8x8 case. You said 66 qubits. Does that mean it's input layer and then one neuron directly?
Yes. So it's literally this same architecture here.
Yeah. Right? So there's one bias for that output.
So you have the 64, right?
Yeah.
You have the bias, but we choose also the architecture. There's one neuron for the choice of
the architecture. Yeah, for the same for all the input.
No,
activation function for.
Oh no! So the activation function is not the same. You choose. So you have a qubit whose measurement tells you whether you are using the sigmoid or the actin. Yes.
That's two more. So that's the same activation function for all the input neurons.
Yeah, but this is a qubit, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, but that gives you one qubit that decides which one of those two is used for all of them.
Yeah. So does it not account for the 66? Maybe there's something I'm missing.
No, that's 60. No, I'm saying that the same thing.
Oh, okay.
64 for the qubits, and one for the activation, one for the bias.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Then maybe I will ask just like an annoying question about the MPS. So if I think about like, if I keep creating superpositions in a quantum circuit, I am quickly gonna reach some kind of complicated correlations. How far can I go in this kind of framework with the MPS MPS simulations in terms of faithfully reproducing what would actually happen on a quantum circuit, or I'm missing some assumption of what to do.
No, that's a totally very good observation. Of course, I mean, the bond dimension should literally scale with the depth of your circuit.
Right.
Here, we kind of not aim to simulate exactly the circuit. We are kind of limited with the bond dimension. So we just fix the highest possible value, and we simulate it. So that's the reason why, I mean, I think the maximum probability that we could do with MPS would be 100 qubits.
Mm-hmm.
I think. So beyond that, we probably cannot go. That's the reason why we are thinking of maybe this multi-basis encoding of breaking down the thing in different quantum circuits could help with scaling. Otherwise, at some point, yeah, we are limited. Also with, I mean, sampling. Sampling costs bond dimension squared.
Right.
So that's also problematic. And we need shots to be able to train, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, that's why we need quantum computers, I guess, than simulating them classically.
Awesome, thank you. More questions?
Let me just summarize. So do you understand correctly that you kind of offloaded the training of a binary network on the classical machine? Now you train actually this variational circuit also in kind of quantum classical regime in order to output weights of your binary network, right? Okay, but did you actually estimate I'm curious actually from the energy perspective, did you estimate like how much overhead the classical loop here takes, like this quantum classical hybrid algorithm?
Oh, how much compared to the
Like if it have this energy objective as one of the objectives.
So that would be something interesting to see. So what we did is that, for example, for the largest case, we implemented this with PyTorch on GPU, and a single forward pass, like 0.005 seconds, is very fast, right? So compared to the MPS case, I don't know. I need to check. I know the whole simulation to have this graph is around 7 hours. Actually, Pietro run it on the CPU, like GPU access.
Probably as a comment. So we played a bit with binary networks in the past. So from what I remember, the main kind of challenge is the actual backpropagation path. So that's where, like, if you train those in like this full precision, then actually quantized into binary precision. So then the challenge is actually to store this intermediate amount of information of data of intermediate weights. And that's actually what takes a lot of like energy and takes a lot of memory in your computer. So one of the challenges in this field is also to find some methods where you can actually get rid of backpropagation in general, avoid storing all those gradients somewhere in memory. So that would be interesting actually to also find maybe some quantum procedure where you can actually propose the gradient updates like as you train binary networks. So instead, yeah.
Yo, so that's why I mentioned about this Koopman thing. Mm-hmm. And the Koopman, basically, what it does is, so you first of all compute the gradient, but then you store it in, let's say, in a matrix. Okay, this is the best parameters after the certain number of gradient descent step. And you basically learn a mapping that will predict the next parameters without you having to compute them again.
Okay, cool. That's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's one direction I want to think about. With this dynamic mode decomposition stuff. Yeah,
in our case, we kind of used Markov chain Monte Carlos to also predict the next binary configuration of the network. It was completely classical, but we used that in order to train these networks. And that was able for us to save a lot of memory and to squeeze it into PGA.
Oh, nice.
are no further questions, let's thank Estelle again.